Okay, I take that as a polite no thank you. Well, Wesley, you know, I mean, you're free to do your thing. Again, I would strongly advise you to break into smaller segments, and we'll see how it goes, because, you know, if you go on for 3 minutes and it's all kind of attenuated down to 30 decibels below hearing, it's not going to be terribly entertaining. But, you know, if you want to, give it a try, and we'll see how it works.
Into exit. Somebody who does it doesn't do it to me, because I'm here to help, not to hurt.
Zulu Charlie.
Hello, John. How are you? Thankfully, John, you're on Echo Link, which isn't having this problem. Glen Oaks is having a little bit of a problem here. So, what can I do you for, John?
Yeah, good evening, boy. I'm a little late getting in, and thanks again for all you do on the net. Always enjoy it. So I got a question, not ham related, but yet scientifically related to ham radio. I've always heard with X-rays that affect by how many X-rays you get in your body, where it could become a hazard to your health. So I think I know the answer. I think it's accumulated damage to your cells, your DNA, but I'm not sure. So I figured let me run it by you. IHK, November 2 is with Charlie, AC2GS.
Okay, John. Well, as you no doubt know, we like to talk about gamma rays and X-rays as ionizing radiation. That means electromagnetic waves interact with atoms and molecules in different ways depending upon the frequency of the electromagnetic wave and the inherent energy. As you go up in frequency, the electromagnetic wave has more and more energy. So at very low radio wave frequencies, there isn't that much that it can do damage to an atom or a molecule. It basically just gets translated into kinetic energy. So it shakes things up, and as we all know, temperature is average kinetic energy, so it heats things up. That's why you stick your stuff into the microwave and you push the button, and it's nice and hot, because the electromagnetic waves are bouncing the molecules around and increasing their average kinetic energy. When you get to a certain point, though, there's enough energy in the electromagnetic waves to wreak havoc. What they do is they rip electrons right out of the molecules, which makes them kind of very reactive, and they'll cross-bond or mutate or just... You're basically destroying molecules. Now, if you destroy a protein molecule, so be it. If you destroy a DNA molecule, you're in real trouble. The body has some degree of repair capability, but if you slap it silly too much, there's only so much that it can take. So it's a function of the intensity. The higher the energy of the electromagnetic wave, And the more of it you slap at the cells, the more damage you're going to do to genetic material, and you might cause cancers to occur. So it's a combination of the high energy dose. You know, is it low energy dose? Is it high? So what's the frequency and what's the duration? Now, it makes good sense to me personally. You know, the more high energy radiation, electromagnetic radiation, the more ionization, the more disfiguring the molecule, ripping it apart sometimes, replacing it incorrectly can provoke a lot of things. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, what I was specifically asking is they have what they call safe dosages, or not safe dosages, but the guidelines. Okay, this much radiation for a person who works in the field with it, and this much radiation is considered safe, let's say, for a CT scan. But I always read that there's and what they call an accumulated lifetime threshold also. Like, I'm just going to make up a number. If 30 millisieverts is considered okay, but now if you have 4 CAT scans or 10, and then it's that they use this terminology, I'm going to say, of an accumulated effect where then they believe it could become dangerous. So I'm just thinking that it's well, you know, in a certain amount of cellular damage is we're going to call acceptable, but if you keep doing this much, you know, there comes a point where we're going to say, no, you know, no more. I think that's what it is, and would you agree with that?
Well, I mean, ultimately the big problem is it's impossible to be in a completely radiation-proof environment for your entire life. Just going out into the sunlight is going to get you a little bit of gamma rays because that's just the nature of reality. Eating a banana is going to give you radiation. Bananas contain potassium. A small portion of potassium is potassium-40, which is a radioactive isotope of potassium. It has a very long half-life, billion years, I think, because you have billions of potassium atoms in your banana, there are some decaying potassium, you know, after you finish it. So you're always going to get exposed. So, you know, people do statistical analysis and try and figure out what is a relatively tolerable amount of radiation. And that's kind of what comes into the cumulative effect. Now, you know, your body is not really the body you were born with. If you ever have pictures of you when you were an infant, obviously there's a slight difference between you now and you then. So there's a lot of atoms and molecules that get exchanged along with cells as you get older. So unfortunately, it's a somewhat more complicated. So some cells last in your body for a long time, some don't. So there's a statistical way of kind of averaging everything out and suggesting that, you know, if, you know, and then there's different levels that you can expect for different employment. Guys who are airplane pilots inevitably get exposed to more space gamma rays because they spend a lot of their time in higher elevations than you and I. So, yeah, it's duration and intensity, and you can shield, but you know, no one's going to kind of live in a 5 foot deep lead box their entire lives. So you have to make the best of it, and you know, we're all kind of exposed to all kinds of radiation. There's a great story that Kodak in upstate New York discovered that the United States was playing around with atom bombs when they discovered that their photographic film was being exposed because of the radiation that was blowing off from places like Arizona and New Mexico. This is, I think, back in the 50s.
WA2 ZFM.
Yes.
Just a point of information. I think in medicine, you have to look at the risk versus the of doing any type of imaging study. That is best to the other. If you have a patient who presents in the emergency department, and there's a strong excuse me, possibility of stroke, and it is medically indicated, you go to. You know what? I've had brain over head metal. So, yes, there's no mention of this. Get that benefit.
You know, Stu, surprisingly, you know, this guy is pulling the same stuff with the noise and then the attenuation, and somehow I pretty much know everything that you said. So maybe we just mind read each other. I don't know. But yeah, that certainly is. You know, I mean, we're sort of kind of talking about radiation purely as a risk, where it doesn't enter as a positive. Radiation can be a positive. Radiation is used for a whole bunch of different things. Positron emission tomography wouldn't work without the positron. A lot of oncology cancer treatment is burning off high metabolic rate cancerous cells with radioactivity. So I think that John was more discussing just generic environmental exposure to radiation as opposed to intended exposure for medical testing.
Okay, WA2VS. Well, I have no idea one way or the other, but I think to have a more of a discussion or analysis, John would probably agree with me. We're exposed to radiation by choice and other times, but, you know, not by choice. And it's always medical sounding that you put the risk versus the reward to make the decision.
Yeah, I understand that, Stu. And again, I agree with you. It's not quite the same question as I think John was specifically asking, that there are cases where radiation, there might be a slight increased risk of developing complications to it, but the risk-benefit ratio warrants using it. A conversation could be made for that, but I think we're all sort of in agreement. Don't expose yourself to radiation unnecessarily. In the old days, there were floor shine stores where there were fluoroscopes that you could irradiate your feet just to show that your toes wiggled and such, and that was not a good idea of exposing people to x-rays for the sake of selling a bunch of shoes. I think we all agree in that, but I don't think it's exactly what John was looking to discuss in that, you know, life is dangerous and radiation is a part of life, and modern life has a lot more radiation. There was a time when radiation was kind of a new thing and people were promoting it for all kinds of foolish health benefits. There was decanters that you pour in water, and there was a radioactive source, so it irradiated your water, and then you drank the water, and you lived forever. So, you know, there's always been that quackery that goes on with any new technology, and those are dangerous people. But, yeah, in general life, like the average banana does have radioactivity in it. It does produce positron decay, so, if you ever wonder whether you're emitting positrons, if you had a banana, you're emitting positrons. Not a lot, but enough to set off a Geiger counter if it's sensitive enough.
John, does that answer? Does that help in any way?
Unfortunately, this guy is not being subtle anymore. I guess he's upset with the fact that I could almost read your mind. So he just kind of covered you from top to bottom. So I'm sorry, Stu, but except for the comment about John, I'll ask John if he was able to understand your comment. But, you know, this guy, unfortunately, rather than being fatigued, he feels challenged, I guess. Anyway, John, what do you got to say?
KC2SA2, was that directed at me?
No, I'm sorry, John. I realized that you were listening to us, but because N2ZC was kind of the only John that was participating right now, I felt I would save myself a couple of letters. I was alluding to N2ZC, but yeah, John, you're always welcome to join in, especially since you would join in through an alternative site that our friend out there can't jam.
Okay, I did chime in with a comment, so I guess you didn't hear that. Okay, let me know when you're ready for my comment. KC2SHO.
Okay, SHO, I did not hear it at all. It probably was kind of lost in the background noise from our friend. So feel free.
Yeah, first of all, my apologies, I didn't hear the original question. But the subject is something, of course, which I have great interest in. I'm not going to claim to be the expert on it, but I do work in the nuclear count room here at Los Alamos, so I would love to hear a little more about what the question was, if restating it is something you want to do. If not, no worries. Two, a correction to your story about Kodak. Kodak detected the first nuclear explosion, the Trinity test, on their photographic paper. It was dots that were appearing on their paper after exposure. They were using the film, and they saw these dots afterwards, and they came to the conclusion the only thing this could be was nuclear radiation. And when they went to the government said, listen, you guys need to keep quiet about this as long as you can. Or maybe they threatened them even further than that, because this was serious stuff. So it was the first explosion, not the 50s, but the Trinity test that they detected on their paper, and that almost blew the whole thing out of the bag. Your average airline pilot or airline, you know, stewardess, whatever, worker, anyone who flies gets more radiation dose than most of us ground mortals do, so, or even a nuclear worker gets. So something interesting to think about there. But yeah, AC2GS, KC2SHO.
Yeah, I'll try my best, and if N2ZC doesn't like my wording, he's certainly free to restate it. But John, N2ZC, was basically asking about, you know, lifetime exposure limits as far as radiation, you know, in addition to, you know, individual cases and how many cases, just, you know, the concept that there's only so much safe radiation you can get over an entire lifetime. And although such things exist, I think they kind of wallpaper over the idea that our bodies are not exactly the same body that we were born with. And so there tends to be a degree of cellular turnover. There might be some residual DNA damage to those turnover cells. So it's probably more of a statistical correlation than anything else.
November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yeah, I figured it was something like that based on the comments I was hearing. So, you know, first you need to decide whether you're talking about acute or chronic radiation. You know, acute doses can be quite damaging to cells, where, you know, the chronic kind of flow thing isn't apparently so bad. But again, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on these things. you know, there are numbers, I should just say. There are dosage numbers that for workers, if you get acute dose or a long chronic dose, eventually they just say, thank you. Your career in nuclear work is over. Please go find a new line of work. So, you know, there is something to think about there. But also in response to some of your other comments, yeah, radiation is used all over for beneficial things. You know, we do irradiate food for safety. If you want to look at something really interesting, look at E-beam technology. There's a guy here in town that works on this, and I love hearing when he talks about it. They're starting to pass, like, produce and things under very, very low-level neutron beams, I think it is, or maybe it's proton beams. Anyway, and what this does is it kills anything on the surface of the fruits and vegetables to help them have a longer shelf life. So instead of, like, a chemical or a something to help, you know, maintain a longer life, we're just killing the stuff on the surface that would normally be mold or, you know, something that would cause the fruit or vegetables to rot faster. So kind of neat, interesting stuff and something to think about that we have for the future. EC2, GSKC2, SHO, go ahead.
AC2GS. N2ZC wanted to say something, so we'll give him a little pause and opportunity to respond. When I was a kid, I visited the New York World's Fair, and one of the few places I actually got to go with my family, because my sister kept dragging us all into beauty things, was the Atomic Energy Commission, and they had these lovely little booklets, and one of the booklets was preserving food with atomic energy. And, you know, it only took them 60 years.
WHVSM was wanted to...
Yes, Boo, feel free. It's only, I caution you that your signal is going to be semi-unreadable because of our friend in the background, but give it a try.
This is higher power. Excuse me. This is higher power.
Well, you're still able to attenuate your audio at the end by about 15, 20 decibels, but give it a try.
Okay, and that's a factor that needs to be taken into consideration. And you could tell me if you're wrong. Our cells don't divide as quickly at older age as it does in a younger age. And I think that also, while you don't sit there to age
as quickly as
I seem to recall there might have been less damage from ionizing radiation when it is very slow cell division rather than cell division. You might tell me whether I...
Well, yeah, in principle, yes, but, you know, the human body is not kind of a uniform thing. Some organs renew themselves semi-daily. The lining of your intestine sloughs off very frequently, and so the metabolic rate of the cells that line your intestine. That's why, you know, every so often if you hear stories of people with radiation damage, one of the first things that fails them is the GI tract erodes, simply because that quickly metabolizing and reproducing cell line dies out, and it causes tears in their GI tract, and everything gets mixed up in the abdominal cavity. So although older people are a little bit slower as far as their metabolism and as far as the cell reproduction, different cell lines take place at faster rates than other cell lines. So it's a complicated situation like most things in life.
Okay, well, I thank you for that. I agree with your understanding. And I just wanted to make sure that anyone who might be listening to my voice would realize that that is also a factor. It may not be a big factor, of course, but it is a factor.
Okay, very good. N2ZC, you wanted to say something. I'm sorry if I cut you off. Please, feel free.
Yeah, thank you, Roy. I remember I read the BEAR report, B-E-A-R, which was from the National Academy of Sciences. I got the impression it was considered the gold standard for radiation and the human body, and they did, it caused some controversy because they got their data from survivors of the Nagasaki and Hiroshima bombs, and they measured distances from the bomb, a rise in cancers and within certain geographic areas, you know, expanding out. And they came up with a figure, if my memory is correct, and I think it is, they could not detect any rise in cancers unless the exposure was 100 millisieverts or more. And I hope I said that right, millisieverts, but you'll correct me on that. And a lot of times you'll see with CT scans, they'll have different amounts for every scan. I think it was the most. You get the most sieverts out of that. I think it was still under 100, but very close. And so I just wanted to also say in the BEAR report, yeah, they broke it down also by age groups. And as the other station said, that there's the theory out there that your cells divide less frequently and makes you less prone when you get this radiation. It seems that it didn't show up as early in the older people as it did in the younger. But so my question was, though, in the final, like with CT scans, let's just say you got 90 millisieverts, but they mentioned in that report, but they didn't explain it, that there was an accumulated effect. So even if 100, they didn't measure any increase in cancer unless it was 100 or more, if you got every 6 months a 90 millisievert CT scan, after a while the doctor's supposed to cut you off. They said it's an accumulated effect. I found that very interesting. It was never explained, though. HK, November 2, Zulu Charlie, AC2GS.
Okay, is AC2GS. Well, yeah, like we mentioned before, I mean, there are damage that's irreparable and very difficult, and then there is minor damages that are kind of fixed up a little bit. There are mechanisms biologically, again, because we evolved on a planet that exposes us to some low level of gamma radiation no matter what you do. So there are repair mechanisms, and you can get away with a little bit of damage, but if you keep on pounding away at it, it compounds the probability that our mechanisms simply can't correct for it. So in addition to acute episodes of radiation damage, you have these unfortunate cases of slow indolent radiation damage that becomes more and more problematic the more exposure you get. You know, when it's a little bit of damage and then you expose yourself, there's a little bit more damage, so it accumulates. I don't think it's completely additive. You know, if you have a fatal single dose and you just kind of add up, if you spread out the single fatal dose to 40 years of your life, I'm sure there's some correction that's required, because simple math probably wouldn't get you the right answer. But yeah, there are cumulative damages to anything. If someone comes by your house once a month to punch you in the head, you know, the first time you may have a headache, the next time you may have a broken nose, the next time you might have a broken cheek, and you know, every time you get the punch, you know, you're dealing with kind of a structure that's already been partially damaged. So, you know, it can be difficult to kind of understand the concept of accumulated cell damage due to repeated exposure to radiation.
Okay, well, yeah, thank you. That's what I suspected. The way it was, you know, just mentioned in the report, and I don't want to fault them in any way, it almost made me wonder, and I think other people too, it almost sounded like it deposited something in your body, and then, you know, more and more, you would, like, in other words, it would deposit 60 millisieverts, and then you're getting another deposit, and now you reached it. But, you know, I didn't think that was it. I think it was what you said, but I wanted to check it. I don't even want to say they worded it poorly, because they probably never even thought that somebody like myself or some other inquisitive people would hang on those words and say, huh. So, okay, thank you again, Roy, for, you know, just confirming that, and just wanted to throw it out there as part of the topic. So, HK, November 2, Zulu Charlie, I'm on the side, and thank you for everybody with all the responses and the comebacks.
You're welcome, John. Yeah, it's not a matter of accumulated radioactivity or something that just kind of sits on the cell. It's just the non-terminal damage that occurs with each exposure to radiation. That's all it pretty much amounts to. That, you know, it might start out if the time and intensity is weak enough that it's not going to do anything. There's not a high risk of malignancy forming, but there's some degree of cell damage, and you just keep on pounding on the cell. Eventually, it'll shift from, you know, some inconsequential damage to consequential damage. So I thank you, as always, John, for your participation, especially in this weird day that we are particularly looking for Echolink and All-Star Node participants. I thank you, John.
SHO with another comment.
Yes, our other John.
Yeah, real good. Enjoying the conversation. You know, another thing to consider, I realize, you know, causation, correlation is not causation, but it also doesn't mean that it's not, you know. There's a famous story, I'd have to look it up to find the name, I don't recall it right now, but there's a famous story about a release getting into a metal recycling stream, and that some metal beams or something that became this apartment complex were made with this recycled metal that had this isotope in it. I forget what it was, I'd have to look at all the details. And when they studied people who lived in that apartment complex, they had a lower rate of cancer than the average. So, again, correlation, not causation, but something to think about, perhaps. Anyway, that's my final comment. Go ahead. AC2, DSK, C2, SHO.
Okay, I mean that's why, you know, statistics has a B function, and, you know, you have to kind of prove that you've proven it, you know, within a certain level of certainty. And even if you do that, even if you have 95% certainty, there's always that 5% statistically that's wrong. And then there's more than a few experiments that were fundamental that had to be thrown out because their 5% error rate was enough to cause an error. There was a vaguely similar non-statistical story I once heard of, I think it was a junk dealer who had found this interesting piece of metal thrown in his junkyard, and unfortunately he decided to give it to his son, who really liked it and kept it on the nightstand for a long time until he was diagnosed with cancer. And people were kind of confused, and they actually tested it, and it was radioactive. So it was some piece of stuff that some idiot, rather than disposing of the way you're supposed to, just kind of threw it in the garbage.
HK, November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Yes, M2 Zulu Charlie?
Yeah, you know, as we're having this conversation, it's bringing back some stuff in my mind. I just wanted to share it with the group. Well, one thing that was interesting in that report, like I said, it caused some controversy because the, like you had mentioned, Roy, you know, the frequency of the radiation determines, you know, how much damage it does because of the energy. And a lot of people said, well, the Bear report, you know, isn't valid. They're using this measurement of safety, but that's from, you know, an atomic bomb, which has a much higher frequency of radiation than, you know, a CT scan. But I got to, you know, just to, they didn't really read the report good because this sieverts is a translation of other, I think with radiation, you're measuring correctly, right? There's radons and there's other measurements, but the sievert is, they use it, they translate all the other frequencies that they're measured by, so whatever other measurement, when you translate it into sievert, sieverts is a measurement where the first biological damage can be assessed at that frequency. And so when you convert all of these frequencies into sieverts, then that 100 millisieverts will be the threshold for damage to biological tissue, regardless of the frequency. So I just wanted to throw it out there, you know, since we're in the topic. I thought that was very interesting and very scientific and professional of them.
Yeah, I agree. Yes, John?
Yeah, I just want to make sure we're not confusing, like, things like RF radiation. Remember, the word radiation just means, you know, to come out of, basically. Because he's saying frequency, but we don't measure radiation of that type in frequency. You have energy and count. That's kind of it. So there's types that you can tell by the energy. You can usually figure it out. You know, you've got alpha, beta, gamma, x-rays, neutrons. So, you know, it's not really frequency that we're talking about. You know, if it's alpha radiation, man, you can block that with a piece of paper, no problem. You can walk around with a paper skirt on and the alpha radiation is not going to bother you. You know, you get into something, you know, beta, gamma, stuff like that, is going to be different. It's going to be able to pass through materials and not be absorbed by something so simple as a piece of paper. So it's not frequency. It's type, energy, and count, I think, is really what we're talking about here. Again, not an expert, but I learned a few things hanging around the people who are. KC2,
SHO. Yeah, there's a bunch of different things that ionize and interact. There's solid particles. Alpha particles are basically just helium nuclei. Beta particles are just free electrons traveling at high velocities, and they both produce damage. We were sort of talking more of gamma / X-rays because the definition has been screwed up immensely. In the old days of physics, X-rays were produced by high voltage differentials, and the gamma rays were produced by decay products. In astronomy, it's all gamma rays. They kind of give a range for X-rays and a range for gamma rays. But since it's astronomically, it's very difficult to understand what the origin of the electromagnetic waves are. They tend to be called gamma rays. So when I was talking about frequency, I was pretty much talking about X-ray and gamma rays. That the electromagnetic waves, and they're all both electromagnetic waves. The difference between a relatively benign radio wave and a very dangerous gamma burst is not only magnitude, but it's the frequency of the electromagnetic wave. And as you increase the frequency of electromagnetic waves, the amount of energy that they have increases. You go from a non-ionizing, at best, heating electromagnetic wave to electromagnetic waves that create radical formations in molecules, all the way up to where they just smash electrons and just wreak havoc as you go up the frequency range for electromagnetic radiation. Again, you're right, there's beta radiation, then there's alpha radiation. But I think when I was talking frequency, obviously there's no frequency for a alpha or beta particle. They just exist. There's a velocity, that's about it. Yes, yep.
And protons and neutrons were mentioned as well.
Okay, so those are, I can think, a little bit more esoteric. Yeah, you can throw a lot of things at people. But, you know, usually when you're talking about radiation, most of the time you probably tend to be talking. But you're right. You know, any subatomic particle that's free from its atom is not a friend of mine.
And one more thing is, all the stuff I've done in national labs is referred to REMS as opposed to Sieverts.
Oh, okay. I mean, there are different units that different people use. I think N2ZC mentioned radon. Radon is not a unit of radioactivity. Radon is a radioactively decaying gas that some people suffer in their basement because the mineral deposits that are surrounding their basement. They unfortunately have a tendency to decay into radioactive radon, and people buy radon detectors purely to detect things like that. Any other comments on the subject, please? If you do, feel free. Okay, I guess everyone's talked out. Wesley, I don't know if you're game, and I don't know if our friend is out there. If you do want to try again, feel free. But again, do it in little, small bursts, so that if it goes kablooey, I can tell you.
November 2, Victor Hotel Zulu with an off-topic comment.
Hello, Ken. I was surprised not to hear from you this morning, but you're forgiven. What would you like to say?
Very appropriate. I can barely hear you over the noise. We had a high noise level today. I can only hear you in the noise. I heard the net, and then it picked up a little bit. And I'm going to tell you what I heard. I heard you say that four people checked in at one time, and I think that's when the signal levels all picked up. You literally picked up to like an S5. And you said you were shocked that you heard four people check in all at one time. And I didn't want to add to the confusion, and then all the signals dropped off again. But I just didn't want to add to the confusion. I let it go, and then all the signals dropped off again. But I did hear you barely, but it wasn't able, I wasn't going to make it any worse than what it was. So that's my report. That's my report from Nebraska. Back to you.
Okay, I understand that it was kind of similar here. There were times when I would request people to try and make contact, and I would sit back and I would hear someone mumbling maybe in the background. I didn't know if he was responding to me or propagation just slightly bled into, he was talking to someone else, because I couldn't make any content of any of it. I couldn't get a single letter in his call sign. And so I just, in cases like that, I just sit back and wish for better contacts. But, you know, every so often things opened up, and, you know, people who have joined me on the 10-meter net, it's more quiet than the TechNet is. The idea of having three or four guys simultaneously check in is something that I don't recall happening for a couple of years now. And all of a sudden, there was just four people at the same exact time. The strongest signal that I got the most part of the their call site is the one that I went with. And, you know, sometimes I was able to pull all three or four of them out, but it's an interesting exercise. It hasn't happened recently, unfortunately, but, you know, maybe it'll get better. But, yeah, I understand that, Ken. You know, we have some regulars who DX to us, and they weren't able to get in. There was a, you know, I mean, usually in Brooklyn, the noise floor kind of goes up around 11:30, 12 o'clock, and it gets to what I call crunchy. It was kind of the same on my end. Occasionally, I was dragging call signs out of the void, using every last person who was listening on the net as a relay. That's another problem with the 10-meter net. A lot of times we have serial contacts. People come on, they talk for about 10 minutes to me, and then they say, well, I got to start breakfast, and they leave, and I get another guy, and I do that for 10, 15 minutes. And so there are some 10-meter nets where it's me and one other guy, but the one other guy changes every 10, 15 minutes.
Very good. Right now I'm driving back from Walmart. There's a two-hour time difference. Right now it's 7:48 in the evening here. So it's 9 o'clock in the morning when the net starts precisely this morning. You were very precise. I had my cup of coffee and I tuned you in at 28.376. And it was great, you know. I could hear you in the noise. And then, you know, I was listening for a couple of hours when the... your signal picked up later on, you know? And all four people, you know, log jammed you in there. It was funny. And it was very interesting, you know? But I want to thank you for your perseverance. And you even made a comment that there weren't many check-ins in the last couple of go-rounds, the last couple of weeks. I think it has a lot to do with the propagation we're having. Kind of funny into New York from where I live. You know, but it changes, comes and goes, you know. And I'm having great propagation towards Ontario, Canada. There's a repeater in Ontario on 10-meter FM that's just slamming me. It's like it's right in my house. But Ontario, Canada is only about 800 to 1,000 miles away. It's not all that far away. And California is coming in very well here into the Midwest. But the East Coast has its moments. It's not doing so well lately. And Europe is not doing that well lately. This cycle is not that good for Europe. Okay, and I'll leave it at that, hand it back to you, and say thank you for your perseverance. And I'll check in every Sunday. I'll do my best on every Sunday. Back to you. This is November 2, Victor Hotel Zulu Mobile. Over to the next control.
Okay, I appreciate it always, Ken. Yeah, it's very interesting. Generally speaking, I've talked to Namibia, I've talked to Florida, I've talked to California, I've talked to Texas, I've talked to Minnesota. I usually do not talk to Canada. They're just not there. And yet, this morning, I spoke to two BE stations, two Canadian stations this morning. So that was an interesting thing. Okay, well, we'll give Wes another try. I think he had stepped away from the radio. I don't know if he's game to try again, but if you're out there, Wesley, if you want to try again, we can try it. Okay, I guess he stepped away, or maybe he's building some massive linear amplifier. I don't know. Anyway, once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net, going strong for 43 darn years, and we're still doing it. Well, back then, I wasn't doing anything. I didn't have a license. Dick was doing it. But we persevere. We keep on going, and thankfully, all you people show up and help. Once again, if anyone has any questions, comments, or topics for discussion tonight, we do have a little bit free time before the SpaceNet report. So please hit that push to talk and say your piece.
HK, November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Okay, Jeff first, and then N2ZC second. So, Jeff first.
I yield to the other station.
Okay, then it's your turn, N2ZC.
Oh, yeah, no, I was just going to jump in rather than see it go dead. If nobody has nothing to say, my question might be for the space report there. I wanted to get a better definition on orbit. I was listening to one of these internet podcasts, and I found it interesting, but I didn't understand all of it, where they were saying that, like, Elon's rocket takes off straight, but then it uses most of its power to go off, you know, in an angular direction to get into orbit. And what they said was that when you get into orbit, the trick to it was that you have to be going, as you're circling the Earth, you have to be going fast enough that you equal or exceed the gravitational pull. So as you're coming across that curvature of the Earth, you're being pulled down, but you're constantly ahead of that curve, falling into the Earth. It left me with a few questions. Wouldn't you eventually be pulled down then? What's the whole idea? I know orbit is a big thing with space travel. They seem to use orbit and then go to another planet, the moon or whatever. I just want to get a little explanation on that. But again, that might be more for the space channel. It's a space program next.
Okay, I'll put in my two cents, and Paul will hopefully correct me. Basically, orbit is kind of like in free fall, like the ISS. It's not zero gravity. It's near zero gravity, but it's always falling into the Earth, but it's falling at such a velocity so that it reaches an equilibrium state. And you could have things naturally be in orbit like the moon, but usually it's a dynamic process and it doesn't, it's not static. So as the years progress, the moon will slowly go farther and farther away from us in a higher and higher orbit. Other things in lower orbit will tend to kind of eventually fall to Earth. That's why some old satellites and garbage and such eventually just a drop out of the sky. And you can, of course, accelerate an object that's in orbit so that its velocity is faster than it needs to be in orbit, and it breaks out of orbit and goes to wherever you want it to do. And there are things like slingshot effects where, you know, if you're not positioned correctly for the object you want to go straight to, you go into orbit, and when you're close enough to be pointing in the general direction of that heavenly body, that's when you hit the thrusters and break the orbit and go straight out into outer space. But, Paul, if you got a better explanation, please feel free.
Okay, well, he brought up Elon and his starships, those big ones that he's launching. They've already done six of them. Their plan is not to go into orbit, those six, and the next one is not going to go into orbit either. believe number 8 would probably be the earliest one. And he is actually launching these big rockets on suborbital flights. He launches them to, you know, he gets 8,500 miles an hour, but not quite. That's what you really need for orbit. And then this way, his plan is to make sure that big star stay in orbit until they're ready to. Last thing he wants to do is that thing flying around in orbit. It would be like the old Skylab, you know. Where's the Skylab going to come down? In that case, it came down in Australia. So the plan for those big starships is not to attain orbit. To attain orbit, what you need to do is you need to get up to your speed, your 17,500 miles an hour. But at the same time, on the other side of the Earth, you have to ignite the engines again, second time, to circularize your orbit. Otherwise, you're going to be in a highly elliptical orbit. And that's his plan, to eventually do that. So probably flight number 8, he'll probably launch from Florida, and then when you get around India or so, he'll ignite the engines again for a short period of time, and that will circularize the orbit. And I think that's what you were getting at, but I'm not sure. Anyway, back to you. WS2N, name is Paul.
Okay, N2ZC, you want to respond?
Again, forgive me for these very primitive questions. It's something I really don't understand with space travel. What is the purpose of going into orbit? You know, of course, everybody would think you just shoot and go straight for the moon. But, and forgive me if I'm correct, it seems that there's a method where they launch and they go into orbit and they stay in orbit, and then I think, as you said, Roy, they try to find a position for a slingshot or something and then go to the moon. Now, I don't know if I got that right, but if that's right, what is the benefit to first go into orbit instead of going straight to the moon? Maybe it's impossible, to go straight. I'm not sure on any of this. So I just, if you could just break down the logic behind all of that, it'd be very nice.
Let me take it, Roy.
Yeah, this is your Bolowick.
Yeah, okay. If you wanted to go directly to the moon, you can. The original flights, they call them the Ranger flights. They used to launch them from Florida, and they used to go directly, you know, leave Earth without going into orbit. And then they would get close to the moon and actually crash into the moon. Those flights were different than just going into an orbit first. The original orbital flights of the moon, same type of thing, and the original 6 surveyor flights that landed on the moon unmanned was the same thing. But when you have a manned flight, you don't want to do that. You don't want to just launch from Earth and just go right to the moon, because if there's a problem, it's going to be a hard time to get these people to come back once you go in that forward direction. 17,500 miles an hour for your standard orbit, you got to kick that up to 25,000 miles an hour to leave Earth orbit and start heading to the moon or to the Mars or to an asteroid. So there's a big difference between the 17,500 and the 25,000 miles an hour that you need to accomplish TLI. They call it translunar injection. you need to stay in orbit for one or two orbits, check everything out, make sure, you know, the astronauts are breathing okay, and all the equipment is running, and then they'll give them the go for